Okay. Greetings, everybody. I would ask you to mute out your phone. I'm going to start it, and we're going to have a guest speaker tonight come on directly after me. This is the 26th day of May 2022, so we've been told, and so they say. At any rate, it's in the year of our Lord, as this is a house of prayer call. I announce the house of prayer call as an ecclesiastical private membership association event where we get together as members of that organization that was established by Jesus Christ called the house of prayer, where he said, my Father's house shall be called the house of prayer. Yeshua the Messiah. And we all have understandings of that one I'm speaking of that is the authority that establishes this call tonight. And with that being said, I always remind you of Isaiah 58:6, which we acknowledge as our mission statement, which is the chosen fast, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke. Sorry, guys, for the cough there in the middle and my hiccup. So tonight, we're doing that very thing. We're attempting to get the boot off our neck with to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burden, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke concept, where we have in front of us as a tall order. We always give ear to the different participants in societies and not participants in societies that claim they have an answer to bringing us out of this clutches of a system around us that we all see that attempts to enslave. And many people have their definitions of when that started and what period in time and who was the bad guy. You know, you might say this group or that nation state or the other nation state, or and you might have a lot of your own personal opinions of who did it, who done it, and what time. But what we really focus on in this call is how do we get relief and if possible, if such is afforded, remedy from these situations of maybe mistaken identity. So with that being said, I would like to give your attention to Danny Unger, who's with us tonight, and he is speaking on the subject of foreign sovereign immunity. Danny Unger is, from my understanding, was a chief principal a student, I guess I should say researcher for Al Barcroft, the late Al Barcroft, who's left his imprint on the community of people that are freedom seekers, and some of you may recognize that name. And I'm pleased to have him on our call tonight to begin our conversation on the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act as planned and as scheduled. And would you all give your attention, please mute out your phone, save your questions until I announce them to our special guest, Danny Unger. Thank you, Danny, for being here. It's all you.
Okay. Basically, there is no sovereignty except under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. That's the only law that there is where there has any sovereign immunity. And as we'll see, that only pertains to true Americans, which are the original 13 colonies. You had to be a citizen of one of the original 13 colonies in order to be a sovereign. That's according to the Dred Scott decision, which many people say has been overturned, but it hasn't been overturned. And I don't believe it ever will be.
Danny, could I ask you to speak a little closer to your phone, just slightly, so we can get a little clearer
understanding?
Yeah,
can you hear me okay now?
Yeah,
can you hear
closer,
me okay
that's
now?
Better. Yeah, you want to go back to the premise. What did you say that many people said was done away with? Can you go back and repeat that?
Well, many people believe that you're a sovereign if you have if you're a citizen of the United States, and that's not correct. Me and Al argued about this many years ago, and I eventually won out on that argument with a federal case in which they basically lined it out Under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, the only sovereigns are those who were citizens of one of the original 13 colonies, and that's it. I'm kind of surprised I'm not getting any feedback on that.
Well, no, Danny, I'm sorry. I thought that when we spoke, and I'll apologize to the audience here, the listening audience, that when we last spoke, I asked you how much time you need to lay your premise out here, and we usually give our speakers the latitude to speak out their premise, and then we discuss it afterwards. So we were sitting here like very attentive students to hear what you had to share and put on the table. So I ask everybody to hold their questions to the end traditionally, and that's why I asked you how much time you needed. And we had talked about that you thought you could share what you wanted to share in 20 minutes. Do you remember that conversation, curiously?
I don't remember it, but okay. 20 minutes will be plenty of time.
Yeah, so you can lay it out there, and I'm sure that there will be people that want it, like myself, want to question you. So I've already got some questions lined up for you because I've got your book in front of me, The Argument for Foreign Sovereign Immunity with Regards to the American People, and I have read it now twice, and so I do have some questions that might be intelligence for the listening audience to comprehend your position. So, but I'd rather, if you would, to you lay out the premise of what you are perceiving that you have in print, which we're talking about the body of written, printed, for lack of a better purpose, the law that is on the subject. And you have the floor entirely to spell it out as you see it, Danny.
Okay. Well, basically, what the law says is that the only Americans, to be the United States of America is the foreign sovereign. And in order to, you have to be the offspring of one of the original 13 colonies to be a citizen of the United States of America. And so when you come up and you claim that you're a sovereign citizen, that's a citizen is someone who has an obligation to a foreign government, and I don't think that anybody here has an obligation to the foreign government. So, and everybody else that has come in since the original 13 colonies has come in by permission from the United States, which is that government which was incorporated in Washington, D.C. I believe the date was 1803. And so you can't be sovereign over that government because they gave you permission. They're the creator of you. They gave you permission to create you. So everybody, all the states that have come in subsequent to the original 13 colonies have come in with permission from the United States. So there's no way that they could be sovereign over the United States. And I think that's where the problem is right now that we're having. Why don't you go ahead and ask me questions, Daniel?
Okay. That wasn't where I was hoping you were going to go with this, but I'll start asking you questions based upon your book. Well, let me just do it this way. your premise is that the only position that is afforded to the American people, if I've understood you correctly, to people that are here on America, the only position that where they could claim that they were over government is if they were a direct descendant of somebody who was a directly on the soil of one of the 13 original states. Am I correct in understanding that?
That's correct.
And
you
so
had to have,
you're,
have been a citizen of one of the original 13 colonies in order to be a an actual citizen of the United States of America.
Okay. And that's to be a citizen of the United States of America, and that's the country you're describing as part the one with the Articles of Confederation and the Declaration of Independence. So,
well, the Articles
what
of
are,
Confederation is correct.
Huh?
That is the agreement of under the Articles of Confederation. The name of that country is the United States of America, those 13
and
colonies.
And it was, right, styled very specifically, the United States of America.
Right.
Okay. So, quick question. Who or what are all the people that are not descendants of one of the descendants of the original 13 colonies?
They're immigrants. They immigrated into this country by permission, and their offspring is passed on from generation to generation.
So the good portion of the world right now is our immigrants, then, of our United States of America.
Yeah, if you're a citizen of the United States, you are a 14th Amendment citizen, which is a not a sovereign citizen. There's no sovereignty related to that.
So these immigrants that are immigrated maybe just a little late for the ship that you're describing, they just got here just a little too late, and they weren't able to get on that citizenship that you described. What stops them from doing the same thing that the original 13 colonies did and thumb their nose to King George in this case, thumb the nose to any other one who claims to be sovereign over them and setting up their own little society?
Well,
what stops them from doing that?
Well, there wouldn't be a government. If you'll remember, do you remember the Harkins letter?
No, I don't even know what you're referring to. Please forgive me.
Okay, well, that's a letter that Al Barkoff received on the night that they were going to jail Pam, and he doesn't know where it came from, but it came from Jim Harkins, who was then a representative originally on the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act when it was passed. He was a House of Representatives. He later became a senator of Iowa. I believe his name was John Harkins.
And the relevance of that letter is?
Well, basically it lays out who the foreign sovereigns are. And this is one of the reasons why people have no sovereignty except with regards to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which is the law.
What about the phrase where it says that all states are brought in with equal rights and everything, the original 13 colonies, when we started, the country started taking in new states, there was a phrase in the Statehood Act that said they come under equal footing. What's your position on that?
Well, number one, there is no such phrase that they've come in equally because they haven't. And the only law with regards to sovereignty is with regards to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and that was passed in, I believe it was 1976, that act was passed. And I believe it was because we were getting so close at that time that they had to do something.
So, if you wouldn't mind qualifying, what do you mean by getting so close, and who was we, and what were you getting close to? It begs a lot of questions.
Well, I think we were getting, we as in the sovereign Americans, were getting close, we were claiming sovereignty, and we were getting close to, you know, like a lot of people don't believe they have to have driver's license and stuff like that, and that's only pertains to sovereignty with regards to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
So let me just qualify again so that I understand, and everyone that's listening that might, what you're saying is, of course, very different than most of everything that most everybody is saying. So let me see if I can qualify it and distill it right down. If you're not born on one of the original 13 states and not a descendant of someone born on the original 13 states, you are basically screwed. Life is hopeless. Give up, be a slave, and pay your dues. Life is over.
You came in with permission from the federal government, and so therefore you're not sovereign over them. That's right.
Well, I didn't come in with anything. I was just born on a piece of soil. I couldn't really, I couldn't dictate, you know, I couldn't direct my mama over to Pennsylvania and steer that that truck over there as a little baby. So I had nothing to do with the equation, just making that relatively clear. Since you use the word you and it's plural in its sense, for argument's sake, I was just born. I couldn't have any chips in that game.
That's correct.
And so the other part of the equation, just for making sure that I was, you know, perfectly clear, if you weren't one of those 13 tribes and you're not of 13 states, pardon me, and of the or descendant of it, you are basically a slave here by permission of some congressional body of men, 400 plus in number. And life is over. Thinking about freedom, you're not going to be free. You're never going to be free, and life is over for freedom. You have no freedom in your future or your past. Is that correct?
Well, I believe that Christ is the one that sets us free, Daniel.
And oh, now we're going to get to the real Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. I was waiting for this, Dan. So, but I want to make it perfectly clear. You're saying there is no hope in the position of law that, as far as the sovereignty goes, in your opinion, it was exclusively to a very limited group of people. And I am understanding that correct, right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's according to the Dred Scott decision. It says only those who were then citizens of one of the original citizens at the time that this country was created are sovereigns.
I have the exact language if you'd like me to read it out to you loud and clear.
Okay, go ahead, read it.
Danny, it's John. It is true, every person and every class and every description of persons who were at the time of the adoption of the Constitution recognized as citizens in the several states became also citizens of this new political body, but none other. It was formed by them and for their posterity, but for no one else. and the personal rights and privileges guaranteed to citizens of this new sovereignty were intended to embrace those only who were then members of the several state communities or who should afterwards by birthright or otherwise become members according to the provisions of the Constitution.
That's correct. That's the reference I was referring to in the Dred Scott decision.
Well, I'd like to open up the floor for questions. I have some questions relating, and I don't want to hog this all. And the reason I say that is because Danny announced that he goes to sleep early, and we're not going to have him late tonight. So I thought I should qualify that up front here, that if we have one of our grandstand calls, he had already announced ahead of time he's not going to participate in a long, long call. So that being said, I'm not going to be the question hog. I open up the floor for any questions or comments or respectful arguments to the contrary. I'm okay with all of that. Just be respectful to each other, and the floor is open.
DJ, before people start asking questions, can I just, Deanne, if it's okay with Danny, I found the Senator Harkin's letter, and I could actually read it real quick. It's only like
I'm fine with that, John. Go ahead.
Okay. So Senator Harkin's IRS knowledge. Although the Internal Revenue Code is used as a basis for the so-called income tax, the personal income tax does not derive its authority from the 16th Amendment, Bruce Haber versus Union Pacific Railroad, or any other constitutional or federal provision, as those authorities fell with the loss of our national money standard in 1933. Since 1933, the people have formed a new, unincorporated United States in trust by their silence and accepting the loss of their ability for paying their debts at law. In other words, the suspension of our national money standard created a void in the law. Consequently, a resulting or implied trust rushed in to fill the void. In a resulting or implied trust, there are no terms or how and who is to administer the terms of the trust. Therefore, you cannot put the blame on anyone besides the people for letting the trust be established. The United States government may be the trustee of the charitable trust, Russell versus Allen. And further, the United States or a state has capacity to take and hold property upon the charitable trust, but in absence of a statute otherwise providing, the charitable trust is unenforceable against the United States or a state. In other words, the code does not define who is required to file, what the terms are, but when you use the Internal Revenue Code as your argument, you admit to conveying your estate to the public trust. Thus, all your arguments have little or no merit. It then is a constant battle finding niches in the code which the IRS eventually overcomes, and it comes down to how much you owe and when you are going to pay. In the meantime, you cannot own anything because they put a lien on it, and it is hell getting rid of the lien. You must also remember that you are also considered a beneficiary to the trust, and as such, unjust enrichment comes into play. Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution states, new states may be admitted by the Congress into the Union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state be formed by jurisdiction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as the Congress. Article 4, Section 3, Congress, period. Article 4, Section 3 clearly states that in order to establish a new incorporated state under the Constitution, the legislatures and Congress must follow the constitutional rules. But being there is no prohibition under Article 4, Section 3, or any other provision of the Constitution to prohibit the people from forming an association of new unincorporated states, and just being there is no charter of incorporation, and the new state and just what its duties are, i.e., its intent and purposes A resulting implied charitable trust is formed by operation of law. Set the QV trust. As a result of the following, forget that, set the QV trust. That's my notes on the side there. As a result of the foregoing, when you go into court, the judge constructs the trust whereby he takes judicial notice of the presumption that you are a beneficiary of the trust and that the presumption is the fact until rebutted with evidence and invokes unjust enrichment on your part. Consequently, there is no constitutional law, only the conscience of the masses in the trust governed by courts of equity where all property, real and personal, is held in common to everybody in the trust, i.e., every person reinsures each other's debts and responsibility in limited liability. In other words, by operation of law, the people have formed a new, unincorporated states that operate outside the Constitution under their right to contract and convey their property as a gift in trust, thereby creating relative rights instead of absolute rights. As stated earlier, being there is no charter of incorporation and just what its duties and jurisdiction consist of, this public trust of unincorporated states reverts back to the Articles of Confederation because under the Articles, taxation and commerce were and are under the control of the states and outside the control of the federal government. Thus, the Internal Revenue Code is not under control of Congress, general powers, but rather its authority lies under local law, which is state law slash code, under the Erie Railroad Doctrine. The articles were in force from March 1781 to March 1789. They were never abolished, but discredited by 1786, thus not being incorporated into the Constitution. Most authorities of that time agree that it had not been for the Articles of Confederation, our constitutional republic would not have survived, but taxation and commerce being under control of the states created major problems, as we are witnessing today, under local law. Erie Railroad held that the law of the state shall apply in the absence of the Constitution or acts of Congress. First, Erie Railroad does not say the incorporated state, but the unincorporated state. Secondly, Erie Railroad does not differentiate between foreign or domestic commerce, nor does it differentiate between local or general acts of Congress. I go ballistic when I hear folks say that is the incorporated states that are doing us in. Go to your state constitution and check to see if the state boundary lines are there. Oh, you say, they are not there. Well, then, how can the incorporated states or states be doing us in when there is no boundary lines drawn between the various general powers over the people, and the United States Supreme Court has stated this many times over. The purpose of the personal income tax is to tax those who want government acting under local law, parentheses, public policy, to take care of them, which, unfortunately, is what most of the people want and expect, and therein lies the major problem. Anyhow, silence is consent. Therefore, you are required to file tax returns and share your wealth with the undesirables. That is, unless you use the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, Title 28, United States Code 1602 to 1611, passed in 1976 in order to offer to those who are dissatisfied with public policy a statutory remedy to the Constitution under Article 3. Your access to the Constitution runs directly through the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act in every area in dealing with government, federal, state, or local. In short, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act codified the era of Swift v. Tyson, whereby a jury trial can now be demanded, if desired, in a state court on any statutory issue covered by the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act against federal, state, or local government. Congress specifically stated that the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act must be interpreted by statutory remedy in an Article III court, regardless of the citizenship of the plaintiff under international law outside of the realm of equity, Erie Railroad, Title 42, and other public policy. FSI, Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, also waives sovereign immunity for commercial activities of state and federal governments, which consist of about 90% of government activity. In summation, arguing the Internal Revenue Code is an effort in futility. That's the Senator Harkin's letter. That was given. Now, what Danny was trying to say, if I may, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, Al's wife was charged, I believe, with tax evasion, Dan? Or
yes.
And this letter came from Senator Harkin's office or an aide in his office like the night before to Al's email to help out his wife.
They were going to sentence her the next day, and that came that night, and Al claimed sovereign immunity, and they threw out the case.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it came, they believe it came, he contacted Senator Harkins, and Senator Harkins said they wouldn't confirm or deny it. That letter had come from Deamer.
Yeah. And then back in 2017, I tried to get through to Senator Harkin, but same thing. He wouldn't confirm or deny to me either.
Did Al go through a FISA court? Was it a FISA court that they were trying to bring their action against him or her?
There was a court up in Utah in which they were prosecuting a, and I did the research on this case. I forget the name of it, but they were prosecuting.
Daryl Getty.
Getty, right. That's correct. It was Getty. And they dropped the case, and so we couldn't appeal it.
So how would the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act be utilized? I mean, I see it's it has to do with commerce, from what my understanding of it is. And you're waiving, you know, that sovereign immunity by entering into commerce. Am I mistaken?
Well, if a commercial activity is involved, that's one of the exceptions to the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
Right, a commercial activity, which obviously it speaks in there that the U.S. courts get to define that, a commercial activity.
Well,
but
actually, it's defined there in the code, Daniel.
That was David, Danny, but you go right ahead.
Okay, Dave.
Yes,
I could help. I could help you out if you like, Danny. So, Dave, the Foreign Sovereign Immunity, if you're engaged in commercial activity, it takes away your immunity.
Right, I understand. That's what I was saying. Is that if they claim that you're doing a commercial activity, it would waive any sovereign immunity.
That's right, as well as an intentional harm to another man or woman.
Right. Well, again, that would be a tort, but the commercial activity is utilizing the legal person, correct? That's the vehicle, the 14th Amendment created citizen.
Go ahead, Dan.
Well, the 14th Amendment created citizen doesn't have sovereign immunity, period.
Correct. But if you, that's because it's commercial in nature. Well, there is no nature. The created thing, the legal person, is created as a commercial entity, right? The taxpayer ID, all of that. It's created as to do commerce, which is why they're bringing their claims in that name, because at that point they can waive any sovereign immunity. So when if I'm mistaken or correct me, please. When Al claimed sovereign immunity, at that point he basically was separating any commercial aspect right in that statement.
Well, you're talking about in the Getty case. And, for instance, they dropped the case whenever he claimed sovereign immunity in the Getty case. They just dropped the case. They denied it. They denied our sovereign immunity, but then they dropped the case so we couldn't appeal it.
Well, when they dropped the case, what happened is when he pled sovereign immunity, what he's saying is, okay, there's no commercial activity, and then that shifts the burden to the government to prove there was commercial activity, and they didn't want to put that kind of stuff on the record. So it's better for them to drop the case than to correct the record.
Case dismissed, yes.
Discharged. Case discharged, no jurisdiction to even hear it. So they were discharged and sealed, gag ordered.
And all he had to do was claim sovereign immunity. Past that, anything they go would have to go to a jurisdictional challenge at the very least.
Dan, can I step in for a minute, please?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, John.
So you had to request a jurisdictional hearing, okay? At the jurisdictional hearing, you had to do two things. One, you had to state that you don't have a Social Security number and that you never had one and that you are asserting the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. At that point, you're a state citizen immune to the jurisdiction of the courts. Case over.
In which case, Utah dropped the case against the individual. And then whenever he used his Social Security number to apply for a
mortgage,
then they came after him again. And there wasn't anything that me and Al could do at that point.
Let me just ad lib to that real quick, Ed. So what happened at that point is Al basically told that gentleman, leave America. You can go anywhere you want, but don't come back to America. Because you used the Social Security number after you just claimed you didn't have one and that you never had one. And then you went and used one to get a mortgage. You bought like some ridiculous, you know, $10 million house and didn't have enough money. And so Al said, you better flee the country, because if they come back after you, there's nothing we can do. You just entered into a contract again. And we just said that you didn't have a contract with them. And that's how that case kind of went. That's the story to that case. And he hasn't come back to America since. I tracked down his little brother, who's a dentist in Utah. And yeah, he hasn't come back to America as far as I know. He's living in Argentina.
Is it Argentina or Panama? I heard he was in Panama.
No, he might have been there for a while, but Argentina.
Okay.
Go ahead and jump in there, Ed.
Well, I was just going to say, technically, the guy didn't lie. He doesn't own a Social Security number. The Social Security Administration owns the Social Security number.
Well, it's, when you apply for it, you check that you're a citizen of the United States. And if you don't check that box, it on the back side it says, explain why you need the number.
Okay, when I applied for mine, which was just last year, because I had never applied for one before that, I applied for the SS5. I applied for a replacement Social Security card, and I marked other under citizenship, and they didn't have me do anything else because I gave them about two cases of case law showing that there were two classes of citizens in the United States. And so they didn't have me check anything else. So when I made that application and signed it, I said that I understand that I don't own the Social Security card. I just need a replica of it so I can get the by Trust Act number off the back of it. So they put me the first time I went, they kept me for 3.5 hours. And they must have called everybody on the Hill. And they said, if you were born in Georgia, you have to be a U.S. citizen. And I said, that's not true. There's two classes of citizens, and I can prove it. There's probably more like six classes of citizens today. But then I had the case law, the constitutional case law, showing there were at least two classes of citizens. And then they said, well, if you're born in the United States, then you're a U.S. citizen. And then my argument back was, well, there's a two-part test to the 14th Amendment, which is what I think you're using, that, to my understanding, only applies to newly freed black slaves, which obviously I'm not. But let me say this. Yeah, and I went on to tell the guy, the three supervisors I was talking to, it's a two-part test in the 14th Amendment. It says that you have to be born inside the United States, and you have to be subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And I don't think there's any proof anywhere that I'm subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And so they went and made some more phone calls. And then finally they said, okay, we got it all set. I've just got to change some things in my computer, and we'll send you the card in a couple of weeks. And I got the card. But the application that I signed says other under citizenship under number 5. And underneath it, mine said state citizen, but I could have easily wrote, I could have just as easily wrote American state national or non-resident alien. They're all the same thing. And what I found interesting about your talk on the subject of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is that in 1788, in the Federalist Papers, number 42 and 43, back in February of 1788, James Madison wrote about how he was deathly afraid that the aliens were going to come in and stop the government from forming all these corporations. And so I had to think about that for a minute, and I said, well, who are the aliens that the government would have been afraid of? Well, obviously it was the state citizens of the 13 colonies. So the Foreign Sovereigns Immunities Act makes perfect sense to me, but, I guess you're saying that commerce is defined in several different places, but as far as what the guy said, he was correct. I don't own a Social Security number. I've never owned a Social Security number. It's something that the state created.
Well,
and it says
I think,
on the back of the Social Security card that the Social Security Administration owns the card. Anyway,
okay.
that was my thought on it. Did the states? Yeah, yeah.
The card and the birth certificate are both certificates of beneficial interest. All they are is a pawn slip that you are the beneficiary. You're the beneficial interest holder. Which, in their rules, you're looking at, if you're going to bring it into equity at all, you have to have, there's only, you're not using titles. okay? One in equity, and then you've got three parties in equity. You got a grantor, you got trustee, and you got beneficiary, and those need to be defined.
Right. I agree, but I'm just saying that the guy, technically, he didn't lie. Now, I think what they're saying, what we're saying here now is that the guy went later on after he pled the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and used his Social Security number to acquire a purchase of property. But
he used it as a benefit.
The way the statutes read, you can't really buy a piece of property without giving them supplying a Social Security number, nor can you get a driver's license.
Well,
which is why it's impossible.
That's not the way it is in Texas anyway.
Okay, does Texas say that you must have a driver's license to drive?
No.
Okay, so there you got a lot of people out there without a driver's license.
In Texas, yeah, I'm one of them. I don't have a driver's license.
I don't either. I'm in Georgia. I was born here. But that doesn't stop the police from harassing me, saying that if I'm in this state, I must have a driver's license. And if
you know,
I
the first time
a
I
motor
was
vehicle,
the first time I was with Al, I was impressed with him because when they pulled him over, he said it was a motorcycle cop that pulled him over, and he told him, he said, "You're not going to give me a ticket." And he said, "Yes, I am. I'm fixing to give you a ticket." He said, "I don't have a driver's license, and you're not going to give me a ticket." And he said, "Yes, I am." And he went back to his motorcycle, and he called in. And the guy came out back, and he says, "Where's my ticket?" And the guy says, "Go get on out of here." He just told him to get on out of here. He said, "What?" He said, "I thought you were going to give me a ticket." And the guy said, "You know I'm not going to give you a ticket because you're on the list." And Al didn't figure out at that time what the list was until later on. And he was on basically a list that said, "Do not arrest."
Yeah, do not detain. Yes.
Yeah, but basically, Al figured out later on that was because he had sued him so many times, they quit messing with him.
Well, I read Al Barcroft's book. I do not have a copy of the Harkins letter, but I certainly would like to get a copy of it.
I'll give you one, DJ.
I could do a lot of damage with that letter, I think, over here in Georgia.
I could get that, DJ.
I'll make it available if it's something that we can put on the House of Prayer call.
Okay, great. Well, listen, I really enjoyed your speech, but, you know, I couldn't help but think while you were talking, I know what makes the 13 states that represent the 13 colonies sovereign, but what makes something like the state of Nevada sovereign, or the state of Texas for that matter? Where do they get their sovereignty from?
Texas is not a sovereign state, and neither is Nevada. None of the states are sovereign except the original 13, and that's it. All the rest came in with permission from the federal government, and so you can't say that you're sovereign over the federal government because they're the ones who created you.
And what if I've got a question for you, Dan? In my situation and how I operate, I don't consider myself sovereign. I consider myself that I serve a sovereign, and it's not the United States. Okay, I'm not a citizen of the United States. Don't want to be a citizen of the United States. And I serve God, and I'm indentured there. So I serve a sovereign. Do I claim to be over the United States, sovereign over the United States? No. I'm not sovereign over the United States. The United States is sovereign over the United States. I'm just not a party to it.
Well, under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, you're immune from the court of the United States and the state.
Correct. And that's why I go back to saying that when Al said, I claim sovereign immunity, that would move it to a FISA court, because they have their own court. So that's why they dropped the case.
They just listen. Me and Al argued about this. He claimed that Texas was sovereign, that it came in as a sovereign state. I said, Al, you're full of shit. It's not sovereign. Texas came in with permission from the federal government. And, of course, if you go in and look, all of the states have come in with permission. They've had to adopt the Articles of Confederation and the Magna Carta and one other item. I forget what. Oh, they had to have a constitution, and they came in with permission from the federal government. So you can't claim that you're sovereign once you come in and the federal government is your master. Created.
I don't agree with that. Let me clarify. I'm not a party to any state here. I'm a party to the state of grace. I'm not I may sojourn in Montana. I may sojourn in New York. But I'm not a party to the state. I'm not a citizen of that state or any of these states at all. I have no contract with them. To say I'm a citizen means I'm subject to the state that I am claiming my citizenship in.
Right.
Right? So
right.
You're a 14th Amendment citizen. You're a United States citizen under the federal, commercial code.
Yes,
but
that's correct.
The claim of sovereign immunity, and we've seen it used against us before, recently especially, and when they come in, and I say they, the ones who are the sovereigns, right, the sovereign citizens, are the states themselves, right? The state comes in and goes, hey, that's our agent. We're gonna, it's our baby. We're gonna claim that they've got sovereign immunity, and you can't touch them. So your claim is moot. That's their claim, right? It's no claim because we're sovereign. So when
I've never seen the states claim sovereign immunity. So
I see it all the time.
Hey, so do I.
I see it because we're suing heads of state. So we see it all the time where they run in and they go, we've got sovereign immunity, so you can't touch us. This claim is, throw it out. You don't have subject matter jurisdiction.
May I interject, Dave and Daniel and Dan, for a second?
Yeah, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
This has been my big question, and you keep hearing Schiff, Senator Schiff, and Pelosi, and these people claiming sovereign immunity. Well, I keep trying to find out what they're asserting their sovereign immunity from. Are they asserting Title 28, United States Code, 1602 to 1611 at all? I'm trying to figure it out. I've been sending emails to Judicial Watch to try to figure out, because just saying sovereign immunity, and I'm trying to figure out where their authority is coming from for sovereign immunity. And then when you guys told me what you did the other day about the government claiming sovereign, so I want to know, because in America, if that's what they're doing, asserting sovereign immunity, then I want to know what section of law they're citing, where it's coming from. Judicial Watch hasn't returned any messages to me. But my argument would be, well, then, if they're able to do it, see, Al believes this the way Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act was written, it was to purposely deceive us so that we didn't know it was for us. That's how he believes this was written. And the more I look at it and read it, I agree with him.
You mind? I want to qualify that. Can I qualify that? You said written for us. Let me just ask the question with really for bring it home. Who are you saying, Danny, who are you saying can use the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act? First of all, ask, who is that group, specialized group of people that can use the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act? Can we describe them, please?
I think it was someone who was a citizen of one of the original, or the offspring of one of the original 13 colonies. Originally, Al Barcroft claimed that he was a Texas citizen, but then later on he claimed that he was a Pennsylvanian. And it's interesting, he traced his family back, and they were border guards, just like mine were, my offspring were.
But this wouldn't be for the immigrants of the 13 colonies too. This is actually a very, 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 very small group of people, because back before the United States took over the position of creating citizens, when states were making their own citizens, there was a lot of immigrants that came in that were not actually of the posterity of the people that were there during the creation of the Articles.
Well, they had to swear allegiance to one of these states, one of those original 13 colonies.
So you're saying that act of swearing allegiance to the immigrants made a difference in their status?
No. They became sovereign citizens at that time, according to Dred Scott.
Because they immigrated and became part of the state of Pennsylvania. They weren't there of the posterity. They immigrated. They got off the boat. They didn't win there, and they said, I'm going to swear allegiance to the state of New York or New Hampshire or Pennsylvania. And that
right.
was enough, and that was enough. Now,
are you saying that a sovereign citizen, because as far as I'm concerned, that's an absolute oxymoron, is a sovereign citizen of a state?
They became one of the sovereign people when they were citizens of one state.
So can I clarify? So it sounds like it's getting confusing. Yeah, I'll clarify.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
If I misspeak, what Dan is saying very simply is, if they were one of the 13, if they were members of one, actually, it's all said in the first sentence of the Dred Scott case. So the other language in the Dred Scott case reads like this. It defines who an American was. And it goes like this. An American is one of those people, in parentheses, or their posterity, at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, who declared their independence, took up arms against England and King George III, fought and were victorious, and recognized as sovereigns equal to King George III in the Paris Treaty of Peace of 1783. It defined who the Americans were right there in that sentence. Anybody else, and don't, I'm not saying that I like this or agree with it, okay? But the way that read is, if you were a Native American on North America, you weren't a sovereign. If you were, and it goes, the Dred Scott case is really long and boring. I hate that freaking thing. You want to fall asleep 10 times in it. And it dispels all these groups, the natives that were on the North America, the blah, 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 the immigrants that came in, the blacks, the slaves. And it goes through this whole dissertation. And that's when I read that language earlier. It was for them, by them, and no one, their posterity, and for none other. That was the language. Now, We want my interpretation of all that. I thought about this for a long time because it really bothered me that this was limited to such a select group of people. But then I thought about it logically, and it was like this. If Daniel and David and myself said, let's form a corporation, and we all work, 14-hour days, and we maxed out our credit cards, and we were successful, would we let anybody in our corporation after we finally got through the 2 or 3 years or 4 year crunch of making things happen? We're not going to let just anybody into our corporation. It's going to be a select few. And that's what these guys did. They took what was over in Britain and they said, we're bringing it over here. And now we're going to start the same
thing.
Hey,
John.
Yep.
Hey, John. I would say if I'm looking at it logically, if it's just a select few and no more, then good on them. Piss off and leave me out of it. I don't want nothing to do with it.
The problem is your offspring, your ancestors came here, and they agreed that they were not sovereign.
Well, I mean, whether they agreed or they didn't agree, it still has nothing to do with me because nobody can agree on my behalf before I even exist.
Well, you say that, but that's what the courts have ruled.
Well, I've had courts rule in my favor when I've put this argument out there. When I question who gave the authority to act on my behalf. See, it's one thing to say you're sovereign. I say I serve a sovereign, and I walk in that authority. So I don't worry about what their rules say. It really doesn't matter. I don't care the Constitution or any of these other things. The same way that the Queen of England could care less about the rules of the United States, even when she comes over here, she's immune. She uses sovereign immunity, right? She claims sovereign immunity. So let's say some cop pulls her over, doesn't recognize her, and brings her down to the station. She claims sovereign immunity, goes before some magistrate, and they pull the plug on that cop and let him go, make an example out of him, and the queen goes on her way.
Right. That's exactly what happened.
That's what happened. Exactly.
Right. And that's what happens. But you can't just go, I claim sovereign, sovereign citizen, because, again, I don't consider myself a citizen of the United States or any of these states.
Well, why did you get a Social Security number, Dick?
I didn't. My mother did, long before I even had a choice.
Well,
which is what most people did, and they were told, well, your kid's going to need this in order to get benefits. Why did they issue them at the hospital anymore? Won't even let you know unless you have the application. What's that?
Are you receiving benefits now?
Absolutely not.
I don't either. I mean, I don't receive any benefits at all from the federal government.
Any of their benefits. I prefer to collapse and get back what they've stolen, and I'd deal out my own money. I don't need benefits if I had what they've stolen for me for the last 50, and my parents before me, parents and my grandparents before them, all the way back until they wrote this piece of garbage nonsense.
Hello? Hello? I'm sorry to interrupt.
You voluntarily gave them the money.
Who did? I didn't give them anything.
Well, they took it from your paycheck.
That's right. That's what I call theft.
Well, listen, if you go into a grocery store with a gun, you can get gas. But is that theft or not? It just depends on the way you look at it.
Well, if I walk into a gas station with a gun and I can get gas, that's by force. Tell me how that's different than what they do now.
Well,
right? I get pulled over because my license plates aren't issued by the state, right? And they call it a fraudulent plate, as if I've, you know, counterfeited one of theirs. I haven't. It shows who owns the property that it's on, just like theirs do. Right? If you have a state plate on your car, that shows who's holding the legal title.
Yeah. So, Dave, if I could jump in for a second. So,
sure.
We're getting to now. What are the tools that work to keep us free and maintain that freedom? And so, I had to come a long way just to get when Al told me it came down to 13. The original 13 colleges, and I had a tough time with that. I didn't agree with it. I didn't like it, blah, blah, blah. So the question becomes now, what works in these courts and what can be used successfully, and rather than – because now, as you know, I agree with you. No man has jurisdiction over another man. It's that simple, right? And unless they can show the contract from Creator, from God to – have that contract, then no man has jurisdiction. So the question is, though,
it's not just no man, it's no group
no man, no nothing,
or collective of them either.
Correct. Exactly. So where was I going with this? So it's just a tool. It's just another tool that was used successfully by a man for a long time. Okay, but even him at the end was being threatened from the, you know, he was being told that they're not going to let you get away with this anymore because he just used it too many times for too many people.
I've done a little studying on the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and in conjunction with the trust, you can use it and bring in equity and choice of law, which puts you as a foreign sovereign. Right, a citizen of somewhere else, and you can use it in your foreign situs trust. Now, my foreign situs trust is the situs is in heaven or New Jerusalem, which is wonderful. Okay, and the law there is the law of my of my trust, which is the law that I have to follow, not the United States Code or some state statute or even their constitutions. I'm bound to a different law. I'm bound to a different contract. Let's put it that way, right? Because as we all know, the law arises out of the contract between the parties. Where's the contract between you and the state or you and the United States? Now, if one of you have signed a social contract, I'd love to see it because I've been told that, that's what binds us to an obligation and a duty to follow the rules. I don't remember signing one. And, nobody can sign one for you unless you've given them agency. And even then, you can't sign away your rights. So an agent can't sign your rights away either. Rights are interests in things. So if my rights, again, we do this all the time, but from a foreign situs trust, my trust is in, I can claim sovereign immunity, bring it into the FISA court, as this is what, and again, I've never tried this, although I did study Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act quite a bit, a bunch of years back. And that would give you your jurisdictional challenge, and the jurisdiction goes am I sovereign and equal to the United States? In other words, viewed equally, on equal footing, or am I subject to them? And that's to be, for the evidence to be heard in a FISA court. That's what I thought. And again, I've never tried it.
When you say FISA court, Dave, you mean a Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act course? Is that what you mean when you say FISA court?
Yes. A FISA court, yes. It's a tribunal.
Okay.
a federal tribunal.
Okay, when you say FISA, I think like FISA warrant, that type of thing. Is that what you're saying?
Well, a FISA warrant is very similar. It's a warrant for a foreign entity. So the FISA court, the foreign, what is it, the...
Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, right?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
And there is a court, federal court, that deals with international claims, put it that way, between foreign states. And or foreign estates, because a private estate is foreign to the public states that they're operating. There's properties all over this country that are in private trusts. Most of the politicians know this very well and use them successfully. And then they claim foreign sovereign immunity, or sovereign immunity. And there's where you're getting your sovereign immunity. Not only that, the Constitution of the United States, right? Sovereignty is retained in the people, supposedly.
Well, but it's only the original, those who were people of the original 13 colonies, and that was it.
Then the only ones that can be subject to the United States are the ones from the 13 colonies. That's why when John was saying that, it was frustrating him that only this small group was allowed to be sovereign. And also, if you look at the contrarian view, it means that you're sovereign, that you're outside of being subject to, like what Ed said, born in, the United States and subject to its jurisdiction. You're not subject to its jurisdiction unless you volunteer. And you could do that.
Well, whatever you say. The thing is if you go out and claim sovereign immunity and you're not one of the original 13 colonies, you're just a sovereign citizen. And that citizenship is you have an obligation under federal law.
It's the foreign sovereign immunities, right? Foreign sovereign. Like the Queen of England's a foreign sovereign. What's his name there from Canada, right?
Trudeau.
Considered a foreign sovereign to the United States, right? Putin. Any of these other countries that consider themselves sovereign or equal to on equal ground as the United States, correct?
Well, there's actually a section, Dave, in the... Sovereign Immunities Act that excludes third-party countries. So no, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act doesn't apply to them the way it's written. It actually excludes the third-party countries that you're talking about.
In what section?
If you guys keep talking and keep going, and I'll find it. I'm trying to
give me that section you named earlier. Give me that section you named earlier where the your remedies are under the Foreign Sovereigns Immunities Act. I want to look that up.
Title 28 United States Code, Section 1602 to 1611.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sitting here looking at it.
Just to follow up on the point that I think David's making, I've had many a judge claim when I walk into court, including last year, they would ask me if I was some kind of sovereign citizen. And I'd say, well, I'm no more a citizen than you are or than that prosecutor over there is. Because you had to give up your citizenship when you became bar members.
Yeah.
And so you're foreign to me, sir. If I am a citizen, you're foreign to me, and I'm in the wrong venue. And then I usually ask questions like, is this court registered in a municipality? You know, and I start heading over towards D.C. with the argument. But the bottom line is, one thing I haven't heard anybody talk about, there are two other acts. One is the Trading with the Enemies Act, so I'd like to know who the enemy is. And the other one is the International Organization Immunities Act of 1945 that gave these international organizations, which we call state courts today, complete immunity from prosecution.
Yeah, judicial immunity. Judicial immunity, they call it.
Yeah, well, the judges will sit on the bench and tell you that they have immunity under the 11th and 12th Amendment.
Judicial immunity. I just wanted to read this one little. It's the findings and declaration of purpose of the foreign immunities. So it says here, the Congress finds that the determination by United States courts of the claims of foreign states to immunity from the jurisdiction of such courts would serve the interests of justice and would protect the rights of both foreign states and litigants in United States courts. Under international law, states are not immune from the jurisdiction of foreign courts insofar as their commercial activities are concerned, and their commercial properties may be levied upon for the satisfaction of judgments rendered against them in connection with their commercial activities. Claims of foreign states to immunity should henceforth be decided by courts of the United States and of the states in conformity with the principles set forth in this chapter. Okay? You're talking about the commercial activities and being heard by the if you're hearing it in a United States court, you're subject to the jurisdiction thereof, period. So if you're going into court and you, as a defendant, you can claim, sovereign immunity, but after this, well, actually it would be under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. One, they'd have to prove commercial activity, okay? And it would be determined by a United States court, not a state court. Courts of the United States and of the states in conformity. So you could do it in the state court.
Are you breaking up? Is anyone else missing it, or is it my phone? Because I can't hear you, Dave.
I'm sorry. Is that better?
Better.
Is anyone else having problems?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, I just have a question on the sovereign immunity. I do apologize for interrupting. I have a question. My name is Enrique. I'm from Texas, and I just barely started reading some of the zip files off of the My House I'll Be Called, and there's a few affidavits here, but one in question is with dealing with the sovereign immunity. Is I believe it's under Harold Ellis Bale. Well, anyways, it states here on his affidavit, denial of corporate status. It says, and my question is, what does this entail? The undersigned is not a sovereign or a sovereign citizen, an oxymoron, or any. Does that need to be on the affidavit to claim that sovereign citizenship, or? Is it important to just to remove it or to place it or to claim it? Is my question.
Let me answer your question. This is the moderator, Daniel. And Enrique, just for whatever it's worth, can everybody mute out their phone if they're making a lot of noise in the background, please, so I don't have to mute you out and then miss putting you back in. Just mute yourself out in *6. A lot of background noise in this call. A lot of breathing heavy into the phone, a lot of dishes and cabinets cranking. I'm glad you guys are getting stuff done, but mute out, please. All right. As far as Harold Beale, he had a prior engagement, and wait a second, Harold Beale. Yeah, So I guess he should answer his own questions about that. I don't know if he said he's going to make it or not. So, and that's a specific question. And one of the things that we avoid on the House of Prayer call is doing anything that would presume to be legal advice. So we can answer questions generally, but prefer to leave your legal advice to someone that would give such. We don't do that on the call. We're very, very specific. We toss ideas out and what have you. I will tell you what I wouldn't do if it was with me is I wouldn't use anything unless I knew exactly what it was that I was supposed to do. And I wouldn't be asking somebody what I should be doing. I would be figuring out by myself what I should be calling myself and what have you. So that would be just a good direction to go in. As far as the subject matter, we're talking two different animals. The sovereign that the call was talking about tonight was alleged to be, by Danny Unger's presentation, a specific group of members of a body politic and their access to the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, quite different than the explanation of the sovereign citizen that you just read in the affidavit, which is a phraseology that's being used by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to pinpoint a specific group of disgruntled members of a specific political society that are active in certain activities, and they've defined those things in print, and you can go find their usages and languages and what have you defined. And so there might be some reason to want to separate yourself from that nonsense too. And those are just pretty much generic concepts that everybody on this call would agree on. But in that you did interrupt the question, I think Dave and John were just about to finish that thought. I thought that instead of getting them totally derailed, we can come back to Harold if he comes on the call. He'll announce himself, and I'll send him a text and see if he wants to address that question specifically. All right, Enrique?
So thank you for clarifying that, Dan, because I was just – or DJ, because I was just getting ready to do that, the same thing, because – Al never used the term sovereign citizen, nor is it used. You're either a state citizen who was sovereign, but there was no sovereign citizen. It was state citizen who had sovereignty under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. So, yeah, that needed to be clarified because it was used a couple of times tonight, sovereign citizen, no, state citizen.
So the question that we were addressing was you were talking about not the Queen, and I think the language you're looking for is the Third World language. I believe that's in the 1602, isn't it?
Yeah, I got me open my book up
did
here.
Did you find it? Because he did ask you that about. You said the Queen was excluded from that list because it specifically excluded Third World.
Hang on. Yeah. So. Keep talking. I had to have to look that. I just read that language recently, so I was rereading.
I will say that in the Foreign Affairs Manual on 3 Foreign Affairs Manual 7270, something that's called a third country national is defined in basically 3 FAM 7271-1, and a third country national, otherwise known as a TCN, is an individual who meets the following criteria: is neither a citizen of the United States nor of the country to which assigned for duty, if employed, is eligible for return travel to the third country national, national's home country or country from which recruited at U.S. government expense, is on a limited appointment for a specific period of time, and encumbers a direct hire personal service agreement, PSA. Anyway, the concept of third country is in print, and it's also in the Foreign Sovereign, the Act itself. Did you find that spot that you were to answer that question?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I opened up here. Let me just move my book into some light because I can't see where I'm at. Give me 1 second. Okay, so note that the foreign state itself does not specifically include a sovereign note that the United States of America would be one country, the created United States government would be the second country, and any other country would be a third country. Okay, so that's in that is in the argument for sovereign immunity with regards to the American people. Section 1603.
Can you reread that, John, please?
Yep, I'll reread it right now, one more time. I'm just locating it here. So it says, so to find out who is allowed sovereign immunity, one must examine the definition of a foreign state in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act at 28 United States Code 1602 through 1611. 1603B provides the definition of a foreign state. That entity must meet the claim sovereign immunity. Please take note that the reference to other sections of the code are made as they appeared at the time that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was passed. The original sections should be referenced as written when the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was passed in 1976. Section 1603A and B states, emphasis added, A foreign state, except as used in Section 1608 of this title, includes political subdivision of a foreign state or an agency or instrumentality of a foreign state as defined in Section 16B. Subsection B. Okay? And B, an agency or instrumentality of a foreign state means any entity, one, which is a separate legal person, corporate or otherwise, and two, which is an organ of a foreign state or political subdivision thereof, or majority of whose shares or other ownership interest is owned by a foreign state or political subdivision thereof, and three, which is neither a citizen of a state of the United States, as defined in Section 1332C and E of this title, nor created under the laws of any third country.
And there's the third country. It's in 1603B3.
Yeah.
And, so that's... That kind of put some interesting twist on the Queen situation. So then I went and looked up third country and found it used. I didn't do an exhaustive search. I just did a quick search and found it used, and as I was reading earlier, Foreign Affairs Manual. So anyway, I'll be quiet. Anybody else here got any input, questions, or for Danny who actually asked not to stay late? Danny, what was your deadline tonight?
8 o'clock.
We're just about out. Anybody got any last comments for Danny as he heads out?
This is Ed. I appreciate him coming on.
Yes. Well, I do too. Thank you, Danny. So
you're welcome.
We appreciate the call. We got a record of the call for you for you and your posterity as far as you sharing on the call, and we sure do appreciate you professing Christ to the world, announcing your faith to the world on our call. Thank you for being here.
One last question. How do we get a copy of his book?
It's free.
You're talking about Al's book?
Your book. I got a copy of Al's book.
I've got a copy. I can give him my phone number.
Okay. I can do that. Do you have the argument for sovereign immunity for anybody that was out listening to this call, Danny? The problem is that there might be people that are interested in hearing your what you had to say. They might have been putting a lot of their nuts and bolts into arguments that you just blew out of the water. Maybe. Who knows? But if they wanted to reach your book for any future audience member, including Ed, how would they get access to the argument for sovereign immunity with regards to the American people? Where can they get their hands on a copy?
They would need to contact me. I thought my daughter had, she basically, the Sabbath Disputation is the one that appears on Amazon, but this one does not.
Okay, so it's not going to be put on Amazon anytime soon, or is that in the makings?
It's it's not on Amazon right now, as far as I know.
Okay, so I should send interesting parties your way. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah, just have them call me. You have my phone
there
number.
There you go, guys. You just get in contact with me, and I'll be the front man for that, for Danny. Thanks. Thank you very much. Appreciate you sharing.
Okay. Talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks, Danny.
You, Danny. Ed, is it all right if I call on you because you have one of the biggest mouths I like to listen to?
Yeah. I got to tell you guys, I'm driving, but I'm going to understand that they –
Yeah, we lost you.
Our passport. Can you hear me?
Can you speak a little louder?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, there you go.
Can
much
you
better.
Okay.
Yeah, much better.
Okay, so they want to know about the five-star passport, the process. I went back and looked. I filed my process, and I still have not gotten received a response on that. And I have not gotten my passport back yet. However, I've had several people file the business passport or business letter for the passport before they went in and applied for their passport. And I've got three different people all in California where they're saying that it's a violation of the government code. So I'm sending letters back to those people saying, where does the government code apply to me? So that's really all I've got so far. But as far as my letter that I put in, no answer, no response. And, you know, I don't know what I'm going to get back. When I get it back, though, when I get the passport, my first ever, I'll let everybody know how many stars is on it with a picture of it. And that's
what was a violation of the government code?
I guess the business process letter. They're saying that they can't, if they got a problem with their citizenship, that they need to take it up with their Office of Legal Counsel.
So I bet it's something you need to deal with at the State Department, Ed.
Well, these letters, these form letters, because they're all three the same letters from the same place. They all three are their form letters, and what they're saying in the form letters is that that issue. And
you're breaking up, Ed. You're breaking up.
Okay. All right. Well, look, we'll catch up next week. I really don't have that much to add, other than I don't have an answer yet. That's what I want to say.
Thank you, Ed. Heard that one loud and clear. Anybody else on the call want to jump in with a question, comment, or related subject matter to the topic tonight? Or if they just have to, if the rest of the group is amenable to it, you can change the subject.
I'd like to jump in real quick before we switch the subject, if we're going to switch the subject. I want to give everybody that I'm meeting and listening to and hearing, whether it's Dave or DJ or Danny Unger, I want to really give a lot of thanks to Al Barcroft and his contribution to this whole thing that we're all in together, this battle to reclaim our freedom or keep these monsters away from us and let us live in peace. Because he really did a lot of work, and as I look back at his work, I've been reading his book the last few days, rereading it for the sixth or seventh time, and there's still stuff popping out at me that I didn't miss or I forgot. And when I go back and I read this, the sacrifices that people made to bring us as far as we are today is really impressive. And it's a lot of effort and life force on their part. And I just want to acknowledge Al for that. Al's father was also a Baptist. He's the son of a Baptist minister. So he knows the whole deal. And, I just want to give him some thanks and praise for his contribution, I guess. And Danny,
I'm going to just jump in for a second, Johnny. And I do, John, I do appreciate you, your accolades to certain people that have gone before us, because we're all the product of the people that have gone before us and their research and their influence. But I'm just a little bit confused at the content of the praise in that, and just please try to understand me. The way I've heard it tonight, John, is that only a very few people could ever hope to have freedom. Everybody else has are here by the good graces of those few and elite 13 tribe people, and if you don't have a lineage from them, you're really in no place to even hope for freedom. Just pick up your slavery and be thankful.
Well,
so
yes,
I'm confused.
Yes, no. Okay, let me help out with that.
I'm confused at the praise. Yeah, let's talk about that, because I'm not the only one. If I thought it, there's people out there that thought it, and I tried to raise it and raise the issue. Because, of course, I have a different sovereign immunity, and I have a different argument for it. And I was a Pennsylvanian, and I do have the posterity that was spoken of. And so I'm not in the group that would say, you know, boo-hoo. But I have a lot of friends, and I have a lot of respect for a lot of people that are not part of the 13.
Yeah,
and
absolutely. We don't want to get hung up on that, but here's the thing. Al did give us all a way to access it, even if we didn't believe it was just limited to the 13 their posterity, the 13 original state citizens and their posterity. He gave us all access. He gave us a way, okay? He wasn't giving us legal advice, but he showed us a way how we could use, any of us could access Title 28 United States Code 1602 to 1611, if need be, or should we desire.
Right, and I do remember that, and his point was that they would have to prove otherwise, and they're not coming to the table even discussing. I do remember that.
Yeah, that's correct.
But John, bear with me as I talk. We're talking educated right now. That's so basically a guy's going to come up there and either non-swear or swear out a claim or make a claim, or make a statement, or make a misrepresentation. Don't you think there's got to be something more concrete for the people to put their teeth around than just the of trying to squeeze in on some dead ancestor's rights? Don't you think that there's something there for every man, woman, and child that engages upon planet Earth, as it's called, to have their own sovereignty?
Yes. Yes, you know from speaking to me now that I absolutely do think that. Okay.
I just wanted to bring the argument to home to the real truth of the matter is if we're screwed making the claim of sovereignty, there's a lot of other things we've made the claims on these calls that people have used that they find beneficial interest in. For example, not mentioning names here, but one of our respected elders has shown that perjury of oath to 110.1 has been a very effective for immunity from state imposed regulations once he puts his equitable argument in of his notice of his political rights, where he demonstrates his political choice of election under 110.1. He finds immunities in regards to the application of law. So that had nothing to do with the original sovereigns, but it did have something to do with the service provider's qualification under the or under those, if they were in fact the only sovereigns in America. Every new coming state had to provide a certain level of freedoms for the people that would be held inviolate, and that was the, it sounds like, if what you're saying is true, that was the respect that and the appreciation and the value of the sovereign position of men being sovereign over their own affairs and not being intruded by government that the forefathers would have set in place, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate. Is that U.S.? Are you referring to U.S. United States Code 1101? What are you referring to?
That Art 1101. The argument was on the lawful money, Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1, 1101. And
1101 also has the right to contract, Daniel. The right of association.
Right. Right. Well, what I was getting at, John, was that at the end of the day, and I'm going to do this for. Because I wanted to bring this conversation to the forefront, at the end of the day, each one of us has to look at what we have in our equity sandbox. In other words, we have to ask ourselves this really important question. It's like when you're making a will, you've got to look at what do you actually possess? What equity do you have? So you want to write a list when you're making a will for a last will and testament. Maybe you want to bequeath something to your loved ones. Well, when it comes to our positioning on regards to government or government actors or government claims, I think that we need to ask what's in our basket, what do we know, what's our equity, to what do we have a possession of, and so what do we have an equitable interest in, and what can we probate an equitable interest in? So if you were asked to be in probate right now and you're trying to claim that you are a beneficiary of the public trust, that would be an equity proceeding. Somebody's really breathing hard into the microphone, just to let you know. That means you might want to press mute or get your face away from your microphone.
or
so
they're just moving
anyway,
their phone.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe it's in their pocket with their mouse. All right. So my I want to just raise this question, or to everyone on the call, all the good minds, that what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing from all the sources is that at the end of the day, being the beneficiary to the Paramount Trust puts us in one of the best positionings in any of the equations, and being a beneficiary and a trustee to the sacred indenture and trust puts us in the highest standing in any arrangement with any of these courts, whatever they claim their authority comes from. Because as I see it, they've all taken an oath to the one, and they've all acknowledged the power of the other. So there you go. There's a starting point for what I wanted to bring and what I was doing with the argument for sovereign immunity from here moving forward. Because ultimately, we are a liquid and moving people because they throw off one form of government and establish another. And we need to understand, we need to comprehend where our powers are. What's our equity in the game? And I'm just encouraging everybody to recognize where their equity is because that establishes standing. That word that we don't talk a lot about. Do you have standing to bring this sort of action? Can you prove your standing? Can you prove your equity? Can you prove your equitable interest in that Paramount Trust? What evidence do they have? Did you give notice? Anyway, starting point, comments. Help me out here, guys.
This is an old man.
Hey, John.
One of the things I want to talk about just for a second is I'm absolutely no expert on the foreign or anything else, really. But what I noticed when y'all were reading that stuff was the references to commerce. And the Act, it seems like it turns on commerce. And when you turn around and look at the laws that are in place now, both state and federal, they all turn on commerce. So here's the thing. The presumption that the state brings against you or the feds bring against you or something like that is that of commerce. So they presume it. In a lot of cases, it's a presumption of commerce, and then we don't know to argue about it or to force them to prove it or anything like that. So my comment on the thing is, know when you're in commerce and when you're not, and know when the presumption of commerce is there and how to counteract or do away with that presumption. Anyway, that was my little comment. I yield.
I like that, John. You're absolutely right.
That Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, if and Daniel is right, it's the equity side of the court, not the law side. If you're in commerce, you're in the law side of the court. That's how you know. They're using statutes and codes. That's not equity where you belong. They can't, under equity, you literally are a foreign sovereign. You're an owner. So is the state, supposedly, right? It's conflicting interests, supposedly. That's all I had to say.
It's going to be a short night. Looks like everybody's just sitting down after their dessert and taking her easy.
Sorry, I'm wrestling with the St. Bernard while I'm trying to talk.
It's all good. Anybody else got a comment for the night before we close the call?
Well, I got a scenario that I'm curious about. All right, so let's say that I go out and I buy 5 acres of land with gold. Am I involved in commerce or not?
Absolutely not.
All right, let's say that I buy 5 acres of gold with Federal Reserve notes. Am I involved in commerce or not?
Half the transaction is.
Yep. So I'm involved in commerce. And since they took, since they removed gold and silver
commerce
coin,
is only for the conveyance, Ed. The commerce is only for the conveyance. In other words, you're trading off something, a promise to pay, for actual money.
Right, so but you're, if I use Federal Reserve notes, I'm using credit.
Right, but I say it's half in commerce and half not. You're purchasing equity out of commerce. In other words, you're using Federal Reserve notes, which is nothing, to get something, which is pretty much every transaction. The something that you got is where your equity is, the possession of what you have. So it stops right there. You can move it from commerce to equity.
Okay, but based on what I heard tonight, how do I get title to it? How do I own it?
Make a trust, give notice of private trust. The trust, just like registering a car. If you go from Georgia to Florida and you register your car in Florida like they require you by statute, you're setting up a trust with a different state. And they, on the back end, send for the legal title to the vehicle. When you register in that your vehicle in that state, they're transferring title behind the scenes. You need to contact them as an alternate state or a separate state and demand legal title be transferred.
Well,
most states have a form.
Anybody familiar with Bouvier's, doesn't Bouvier say the title is only transferred by silver and gold?
I'd say ownership.
Yeah, that's my point. Separate. Who else has valuable consideration other than the guy that paid gold for the land?
That's the key word, Ed, is valuable. Okay, and since 1977, there's been an actual act that said that the obligations of the United States had no uniform value. So gold has the value. Everybody looks at this thing where, okay, gold and silver goes up every day. and, you know, when they look at what the dollar's worth and all that stuff, that is wrong. Gold stays one. The money, the Federal Reserve note is what goes up and down every day, not the gold. So when you look at your transaction, the value that you have opposed to no value for a Federal Reserve notes transaction. So that's my take on the thing. When you have a Federal Reserve note transaction, there's no value. And the Supreme Court has recognized that. You know, I told you about that case, the Dallas case there, where the Supreme Court ruled that there could be no tax computed if the tax assessor has to either look directly or indirectly at the obligations of the United States. So basically, on that one case, you can tell your tax appraiser to go stick it up her butt. Was what I'm fixing to do on this case in mind.
Yes. Well, that's the whole point. I mean, basically, when the guy was talking about the Foreign Sovereigns Immunities Act, everything's in a public trust, and we own nothing. But the whole reason we had the war of the Declaration, the independence, the War of Independence, was because we wanted to own our own land. And now we're right back in the same boat where we can't own our own land.
Not without a fight.
That is, if you do a deep dive into the word registration, when you register something, you give something up. So the thing is, we don't know what it is. When these lawyers transact, you know, they complete these real estate transactions, they're the ones that are giving the ownership of the property away.
That's the legal title.
Yeah.
That's the legal title.
Yeah.
That's what they're never showing you. Just like your certificate of birth is a certificate of title. They're not giving you the other side.
Yep.
Once you register something, you're splitting the title to it.
That's exactly
right. You're creating a trust.
Say that again, Dave. Can you say that again, Dave, please?
Yes. When you register something, you're creating a trust. You're splitting title. The place mm-hmm. you registered it with, the trust you registered it with, holds legal title. They get to hold and tune up the laws. You get beneficial title or equitable title. That's your remedy, equity. And only the beneficiary has that equitable remedy. That's what Daniel and I have been talking about.
Okay, so here we go. So what if I bought the land with gold, but I made one of the stipulations in the contract, no use of prux, no trust of any kind, and no exceptions with the purchase of the land with gold? Where does that leave legal title?
Well, you still have to claim legal title, Ed, and we still have to talk about it. But, again, you created it. You bought it. I don't know what name you bought it in. But, you know, if I purchase something, I purchase it in the name of my trust, and I sign as trustee. And it gets registered into my trust. And then I have a claim by the beneficial title that I received from the seller, and I can claim that against the state and basically ask them to, by action of law, they have to transfer the legal title. They're no longer a trustee. And the only one that has the right to do that is the beneficiary, the one with the beneficial interest. The certificate of title. That's why when you go down and you re-register it in another state, they transfer the legal title on the back end. They do the same thing. That's what your lawyer's doing on the back end of your real estate transaction. They're transferring legal title to the office, and you get you get to be the renter.
Yeah, so the question is, how can I be a tenant on the deed that they created, the trust they created, if I bought the land with gold?
Point, and that's a great argument, and I would be mitigating that if I were you. Make your claims. You provide notice of private trust. I would quick claim it to your trust in full 100%. You have 100% equitable position. There's no mortgage. There's nothing.
Right.
I'd like to drop something on you for consideration in the interest of being odd and out there and different. So I've never really given anybody this on this call, this information, but it is on the webpage that I have out there, myhouseshallbecalled.com, and I talk about the house of prayer. And so maybe the problem in the equation is that our righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees, those that are the record keepers. And maybe the problem is that we're trying to own land that actually belongs to God, and the United States has already admitted that the Bible is the Word of God, and the nation is formed with the Scripture in mind. And by us trying to own land in our own name, we're actually found to be evildoers in regards to true equity. Maybe we're supposed to be reconciling all things back to God and leave a legacy for those that are to come following in the ways of freedom and liberty. And maybe we should use the house of prayer or a private trust out from the house of prayer, because that's what the freedom community that was established by Jesus said his Father's house was to be called. My Father's house shall be called. So you want to know what your calling should be? If the earth is the Lord and the fullness thereof, and all belongs to God, then don't be a thief on the record and take that which belongs to God and put your name on it. You're merely a steward over what God has given you. Put it into trust. Make it known that this belongs to God, and I'm merely a steward, and I am here to defend him for his land and the taxes thereon, his beneficial interest in it. And that's where I make the claim. I didn't make the claim from my name. Not my name be glorified. Not my name be lifted up. I made the claim for his name. May his name be glorified, and there's no other salvation in any other name. So it's a consideration. I would put it in the house of prayer and put it in private trust and then rely upon equity to preserve my equitable interest in its use. And that's my two cents.
And that really sums it up, Daniel. It really does.
Is everybody aware
of
that?
You've heard Daniel and I say it before. You go into court. I'm not there in court. I'm God's property, and trustee thereof. And God's got a claim, a right, and in the subject matter. And it's a higher right, it's an ownership right, where the state is trying to usurp that right. And therein lies your subject matter jurisdiction. Excuse me for tripping on my tongue. But that's the subject matter jurisdiction challenge, that you're God's property, that your stuff is God's property, that your kids are God's property. Who is the state coming
to this
quiet title?
And we've got to find that biblical equity, that place where we can raise those issues. So, yeah, they are a course, and only certain things open the gates to certain questions. But if you're in a place where a judge is telling you, don't bring that constitution in my courtroom, I can guarantee you have not opened the door to equity, which is fairness, which is where you want to be, and you don't want to be in a place of a wage slave. You want to be in a place where your equities are acknowledged. And your equities are your interest in that paramount trust that our brother John so eloquently brought to our community. That I love that phrase. And your equities come out of the indenture. So you got two places. Hey, they've acknowledged this. Look, they've all said that they've taken an oath to the Constitution and the freedom of your relationship, known as freedom of religion, They're taking there's a, in their Bill of Rights in the state and the federal, and 97280 of the public law defines that the Bible is the word of God. So you're in a very safe place to rely upon the Constitution to bind them and the law of God to free you. That's my two cents.
Perfect.
I like that. That cuts the heads off the snakes without getting into all the detail right at the very beginning. I like that. That's where I'm going these days. Right? It's the Bible, Word of God. That's it.
John, here in Arkansas, what's really interesting in the Constitution and in what they call the State of Arkansas Constitution, it's a restriction on public office to hold the position in public office if they don't profess a belief in God. And it's really wide open door here to Arkansans, which is really interesting because that's a right of inquest. You know what's been interesting? We all want equity. We're all claiming, he railroaded me. I've heard that in the community. He railroaded me. I was railroaded. And I started thinking, you know, what's the biblical equity that could have avoided a railroad job? And I started thinking that maybe we've left the position of being a judge to any Tom, Dick, or Harry that somebody wants to throw in there to be our judge. And we haven't been good stewards and qualified. Who are you to be a judge over me? What's your qualifications for a judge? As a judge, do you have a belief in God here in Arkansas? I can say that. And those of you that live in a place where the Declaration of Independence has any meaning whatsoever as one of the four constitutions of the United States of America, there's the all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with inalienable rights. You're on the same playing field as any other man or woman, regardless of the fancy dress or costume that they're wearing or shiny badge they shove in your face. And so that's the relationship man to man, mano to mano. Now we have to understand how to grasp that, I believe, these positions and bring them into actions that actually cause a positive change in the world around us, rather than just here in these house of prayer calls. I'm saying we qualify the people. We qualify those that are acting out, and if our children are at stake in a matter, and they're the most valuable thing, then why would we willy-nilly let any man or woman sit in a position to weigh in on my children? Boy, there's a lot of noise back there, guys. A lot of beeping. Anyway, that's subject matter that we've been talking about, and I bring it to the community tonight. That you know we should. Qualify, quo warranto, bring your authority. By what authority?
By finish your sentence. By what authority? What, Dan?
By what authority? By what authority? So, what's your positioning? Where? So, like for example, in the book of Philippians, all the saints salute you, chiefly them of Caesar's household. Go reckon that chiefly them of Caesar's household, they're going to give the chief salute. So there were saints in Caesar's household. So are there people that are in these positions of public trust that are saints? They embody both the equity below and the equity above, and they sit in a position like that. Well, I think we need to seek out if they're there. You better find out if the man that's weighing in on your matter is one of them. You have a responsibility to the property you're actually trying to defend, whether it be your land, your house, your children, whatever it is you're trying to defend. Then you have a responsibility, number one, to maintain your jurisdiction that it goes into equity, meaning you cannot be a beneficiary of the Constitution unless you're in equity. That's what I'm trying to tell everybody. You're not going to get to be a beneficiary of the Constitution at law because, look, they left lawful money. They've left that realm where you're going to where they're practiced in that constitutional realm at law. Please, somebody correct me if I'm not wrong. Aren't they following the Lieber Code and military justice is being meted out? Aren't we subjecting ourselves to exactions all the day long with a debt slave that they give us by pledge that we carry on our backs and they tax and tithe it?
I believe you're correct.
Hey, when that gold and silver went away and everything went to the Federal Reserve notes, the government cannot plead sovereign immunity anymore for the simple reason that they're all corporate. So there's a case out there, and I'm terrible at remembering names of cases, but the court basically laughs at the pleadings of the government where they plead sovereign immunity. And they come back and say, you're just nothing more than a corporate player. And that's what the deal is. So anytime some government jumps up and says, oh, we've got sovereign immunity, you can't sue us, you can't do that. Well, what happened is the sovereign immunity
Clearfield.
Went away.
I think you're talking about the Clearfield Doctrine.
Yes, that's correct. And so Clearfield's pretty plain. There's no money,
clear.
There's no way for you to be sovereign.
You know what? Good
They're all
point.
Corporate.
Almost,
they all have Dun and Bradstreet yeah. numbers, and they're all bankers. There's no way that there's sovereign immunity involved in the government anywhere today.
Correct. Where governments have chosen to incorporate, they've been reduced to mere citizens and must be a holder in due course of a contract and produce the contract.
You got it.
Yep.
Can anyone hear me?
Go ahead.
We can.
Oh, good. Okay, I had a quick question because I know that at one point, and this may be a dumb question, but at one point they had converted the, they had given corporations the same status as people. So how could they not sort of invert that to and use that to reclaim sovereignty, or is it, I don't know, I'm a little confused by that.
Well, you know what, I'm not going to try to answer the question. Why don't you try to re-ask it, because I couldn't put it together in my head. Maybe you can ask it a different way.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So what I'm asking is, when my understanding is that I think it was maybe 15, 20 years ago, they tried to say that corporations had human rights. If I remember correctly, that went through, but I could be wrong. So with that, if that did go through, then would they be able to then say, if they're as people, that they would be, or is it that they're just no longer governments and therefore it falls out of that?
Are you referring to the 2010 Supreme Court ruling that corporations are persons?
Yeah.
Well, then you have to look at the definition of persons, not
okay.
people. I think you're mixing up your terms.
I think I realized that as soon as I, yeah, okay. Thank you. Sorry about that. Okay, thanks.
Question. I just had oral arguments in front of a judge here about a couple of months ago over that exact same subject. And we were fighting over property taxes, and the property tax statute says that any person liable for the tax, it says, okay, the person that owns a property on January 1 is liable for the tax. But then when you go look up the definition of person, you find out that it's all kinds of businesses. So what the statute actually says is, if you're the business that owns the property on January 1, you owe property tax. So I go and I look up the definition of human being in Texas statutes, and the definition of a human being, and it tells when they become a human being and all this other kind of stuff, but it is termed as individual. So since the state does not use the term individual in their definition of persons, they're only talking about artificial entities. So the argument where I was at was, you had to be an artificial entity to owe property taxes. You had to be in business. So to answer your question, I think what John was talking about is, you have to be very careful about the terms used when you're talking about person, individual, and rights with reference to those two types of entities. So You'd probably have to read that case really close to make sure that what you think about that case is actually the way it is.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I don't know if that answered your question or not.
No, it does, and I kind of realized that that was going to be part of it. I just was not thinking it through. Thank you so much. There was another, I believe you had mentioned it, and I couldn't quite hear. And in fact, there's someone's television is on in the background. I don't know if someone who was watching TV could mute that out. But you had mentioned at about 6:28 a reference to something where you rebutted the tax law. And I wasn't able to catch it, and I was curious about that. It had to do with lawful money, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly.
Well, yeah, I'm pretty good with that lawful money argument. basically, what we do with this this argument under Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution, we tie that together with the judge's oath, okay? And when somebody is asking the court to create a debt, then I can pull this on them, and it actually causes the judge to commit perjury of oath and treason if he gives an order for somebody to pay Federal Reserve notes.
Right.
And there's no gold and silver. There's no gold and silver in circulation, so the courts cannot give an order for anybody to pay anything without the defendant waiving his rights under 110.1.
Okay.
So that's basically the way the argument works. Pretty simple when you look at how the cow ate the cabbage.
Okay.
Hey, John.
Who is that, John, saying that? Is that John?
Yeah, John was saying that. John, I got to ask you something.
That?
The right to association in under 110.1, could you make that same argument as to whether or not you want to associate with the government and instead of doing that, use the exit clause of the Declaration to set up your own?
I'd have to go and read that. I know they also 110.1 has a clause in there about the right to contract.
Contract. That's the right of association, is the right of contract. And if I contract myself into a private trust, right, if I have the right to consent to enter into contract, then I have the right to enter into these contracts apart from and separate from the United States.
That's exactly
so I have the right,
right
to associate and have the United States a party to my contracts, or I have the right to keep them out of my business.
That's exactly right. They can't make any laws that affect your right to contract.
Right. And that's my argument when I go in with the trust.
And so here's the deal. You can use that. That's part of 110.1. And I think what clause 3 or something like that. So if they tried to come in and say that you didn't have the right to have your stuff in a trust or whatever kind of thing they were trying to do, they were trying to exercise some ownership to it, then they would actually be in violation.
Jurisdiction. Yeah. When it comes to jurisdiction itself, that's why I said it. You know, if I'm under a, you know, I have the right to associate as some citizen crap of the United States or the state or any one of those. But I also have the right not to.
Here's the thing. That clause, as in with money argument, that clause creates judicial estoppel against any kind of order that affects your trust.
Exactly. Which is separate and apart from their citizenship.
There you go.
Right?
John, can one of you guys
it would be considered
that?
A contract. Am I correct? Because when you come in as an immigrant and you seek citizenship, you're really just negotiating a contract.
That's it.
To be a citizen. If I choose not to, that's my right of association.
And that's the thing, you know, the terminology, and you've seen it in my paperwork, we make political decisions that have legal consequences. And the trick with dealing with these people is knowing when you are making a legal decision and knowing what the consequences are going to be. So you make a political decision, and that political decision has legal consequences, and you just have to know how to give notice of them and enforce. And that's pretty much all I do with my paperwork.
See, John, one thing I did, I used the money argument, and the judge awarded, instead of ordering a payment, he ordered a monetary award. Just so you know, that can happen.
That comes under the heading of an unclear statement. So you have to ask for a more definite statement.
Yeah, I actually did that. To me, that's a good thing when he did it, because he basically put in the letter, the response to me, which it took me 3 letters to get him to do it. But he did put in there, check, money order, whatever, blah, 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 or any other cash equivalent. And then he also told me that it can be deposited with the court, and once it's with the court, then it's on them.
Well, just go get you a handful of pesos.
grab a piece of toilet paper that was selling for whatever it was and just draw out however much the amount of the debt was.
I'll tell you what I do, okay? And I saved a guy's house like this the other day. I've got what they call a conditional promise. That's what I call it. And I did one the other day for $170,000, and it was a divorce thing. And so anyway, the judge in the divorce gave a woman $170,000 for the house. And this guy had a certain amount of time to sell the house and pay her. Well, she wasn't very forthcoming, and she kept a bunch of other money that the court didn't find out about. And, you know, it was a big rigmarole, and the guy felt like she had her money. And so in the divorce decree, the judge had gone ahead and assigned a real estate agent to sell the house if he didn't pay. So time passes, and the divorce lady, she gets to raising Cain. And so the real estate agent came and told my buddy that he needed to get out of the house, that he was going to sell it out from under him, and he'd be back with the sheriff in about a week. So he came and told me, and I put together my paperwork there where I basically give the court notice, and I give the real estate agent notice, and I gave her lawyer notice, and I sent the lady what I call a conditional promise. And the conditional promise basically says, I guess I could read one, but anyway, it says that we'll pay you just as soon as Congress puts something in circulation that is constitutionally authorized. So we say, okay, we promise to pay as soon as there's any money. And so we send that to her, and we send a copy to the judge and send a copy to everybody. And all of a sudden, nobody wants to have anything to say, because I send the personal notice to the judge that tells how he's going to, you know, be committing perjury of oath and all that kind of stuff, and to her lawyer and everything. And it's 6 months later, and the guy's still in his house. So, and I did it for another guy in a divorce, saved him about $100,000, and I did it in my own divorce, saved me $100,000. And so the deal is, you don't refuse to pay. What you do is you make a political decision that has legal consequences. And the political decision is not to waive your rights under 110.1, and the legal consequences are you force the Congress of the United States to do their job. And until they do their job, you have no liability. It's a wonderful thing. So anyway, that's how I, one way that I keep the things legal.
That's one thing in my case, the judge even put the rule of for depositing it with the court. I thought that was interesting. He did that.
I would give him I think it would be really interesting to put in a conditional promise and put it in the court. Because here's what happens. When you do that, somebody has to come back and argue the point. And they'll never do that. They'll never come back and start arguing that. Because here's the thing. I got a spot in the law that says that no court has ever determined the value of money. And they can't, because it's a political issue. And the court can't make political decisions. So what you're doing is you're making a promise to do something that creates a political obligation on Congress. And that obligation is in the Constitution. So the judge can't move against you if Congress hasn't done their job. So I think it would be a really, really interesting thing to send in a conditional promise on that deal. And I also make that promise without the United States, 28 U.S.C. 1741, I believe it is, parentheses 1, or 46, I might be wrong. Daniel, do you have a copy of one of those?
Which one?
The conditional promise.
I will check right now, John.
But John, that would be like in my case, the judge ordered a monetary award instead of a payment. So
John, could you go ahead? I don't want to tell you what to do, John, but this, please, I'm just chomping at the bit, because here you taught us in the past about the findings of facts and conclusions of law and how it lack of a specific findings of facts. You want to address that? Because this is a perfect time for that lesson.
Okay. Well, every state, I mean, I'm not familiar with your case or anything like that, but most every state has rules. When there's a final order that comes out, then the order has to be supported by findings of fact and conclusions of law. And the judge has to write the order out. So if he just comes out with an order, says, yeah, you lose, pay this amount, then you can ask for findings of fact and conclusions of law, where he has to come out and he has to say, yeah, this is a fact. So-and-so said this, I believe it, and under that rule and this statute and all that kind of stuff. So he has to give the findings of fact and the conclusions of law to have a viable decision or order, okay? And if he doesn't, then you have to look at how that operates against you. So failure to put in, for a court to put in findings of fact and conclusions of law prevents you from appealing his order, because he doesn't have, there's no basis for his thinking. So we can't decide, or we can't argue how he has abused his discretion and things like that. So findings of fact and conclusions of law are part of your contract. If you were a plaintiff in the deal, then you're paying for that. And that's a due process violation for them to not do that on a final order. So anyway, that's the short answer to Daniel's request right there. The findings of fact are a due process issue. So for them to put out an order that just says, yeah, okay, you got to put out something. What I like to do when they put out, when they say, oh, okay, I'm giving a monetary award. Well, okay, there's two words right there that need defining. One's monetary and the other's award. So he needs to be specific. If he's going to say that you owe X amount of dollars, then he needs to say X amount of dollars. And then we fall back on the definition of a dollar at 419 grains of silver, whatever it is in the original Money Act. And then if he just writes a number down, then we can ask him to be more specific. What does that number represent? And we just basically pin him down, because the way the system works now is purely by presumption. When they write a number down, you presume it's Federal Reserve notes. So you gather up a bunch of Federal Reserve notes and go pay it. You just waived your rights under 1101 to pay any state debt in gold and silver coin. So that's the way the whole system works now, is on ignorance of the people.
Well, we're all learning. John, I don't have the conditional promise, and it sounds like it'd be worth reading and ingesting. So
I'm on right now.
All right, I'll put it on the House of Prayer group, and I'll send this fast, because I've been slow on the draw, but I'll send it on fast. If I get it tonight, I'll send it tonight. And that goes to you too, John, if you want to get that letter off to me for the assembly.
Senator
was it
Harkin's
the John letter. Was it John Rankin's letter? What was it?
Senator Harkin's letter.
Harkins. Yeah. I'll put them both out as fast as.
What I'll do is, DJ, I'm going to give it to you guys first thing in the morning. Give it to everybody if you want that's on the call. I'd like to get John's number. I'm already laying in my bed as I'm listening, because I've typing up since 5. So, but I will do it first thing in the morning, like 5 in the morning when I get up. I'll get it to everybody, get it to you and DJ.
Okay, here I've got the conditional promise up, and I want to read it to you. It's real short. This is the title.
Excuse me, how do we get on that list to receive the documents when you mail
my,
them out?
What you do, send, well, it's going to be on myhouseshallbecalled.com, and it's going to be on the downloads. It'll be along with this call, it'll be with the downloads, and it's going to be the Harkins and the conditional promise. It goes with this call. So these are the documents that we refer to. Yes. So go ahead, John.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, this is the title. Without Prejudice, Non-Territorial to the United States as used in 28 U.S.C. 1746, parentheses 1. That's the title. And it says, I, so-and-so, a non-corporate flesh-and-blood human being possessing all legal rights and without prejudice, do tender this offer of 100,000 money of account units. The United States Congress has declared in the notes to 31 U.S.C. 5101 that, quote, money of account, unquote, or, quote, money, unquote, for short, has not been defined by any court. As soon as the unit money is defined and comes into general circulation, and the use or possession of the unit does not prejudice my legal rights in any manner, I will fulfill this offer. Equal application of the law requires that this promise be given the same weight and consideration as any other promise. And it's signed Without Prejudice, Non-Territorial to the United States, as used in 28 U.S.C. 1746, Prin 1, and then a signature. And that has been used several times with great success. And I'll send that to you. I got a sanitized version of it here, Daniel, I'll send this to you.
Yeah, and if you had it under the name conditional promise, I don't have it. I just checked everything that you graciously shared in the past. Well, folks, I thought we've had a very good call. I thank everybody for the support. I guess Harold never made it on the call. And it's been a great time. I appreciate you all very much. 2 weeks from now, we're going to have another House of Prayer call. Remember, it's every 2 weeks. Do share with the information with your loved ones. And to be announced, the subject matter, and I have a special guest that may be coming on, but we'll just say to be announced. And so if you don't receive notice of the calls and you're on this call tonight, you can send me an email at IAM, DanielJoseph@protonmail.com. And to those that acknowledge that they're a member of the House of Prayer, I'm happy to send everything that we offer to the liberty of all of you as you continue in your endeavor to fight the good fight. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a wonderful evening. I thank all of everybody and our guests that's left us and all of you that participated. See you in 2 weeks. Good night.